Our podcast today is produced at St. John's Lutheran Church in Salisbury, North Carolina, where we see the church as an important venue for conversations that matter, a place where we can and should engage in good, faithful, and sometimes hard conversations about issues and events that need our attention. For more conversations like these, please visit our website, stjohns-salisbury.org, or follow this podcast on your preferred platform. Briefly, I have to ask a question about Cleveland sports because I know you're an avid fan. What's your favorite Cleveland sports figure?
Wow, Paul Warfield. He was like, they called him, he was just a great player. And then Ozzie Newsome was a great player. And they would call him the Wizard of Oz. Yeah.
That's awesome. And you didn't even mention Jim Brown.
Well, you know, he's a little before my time, but yeah, he's like, of course. So I should say, of course. And Leroy Kelly after him. And, you know, I like Bernie Kosar because he's also an Ohio product and from Youngstown. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rhodes Woolley, and I'm pleased to have with me someone who is well-known in Lutheran circles, Reverend Dr. Elizabeth Eaton, who serves as the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a position she has held since 2013. Bishop Eaton grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, which by birthright makes you an avid Cleveland sports fan, despite living in the Windy City for the last 7 years. My guess is you are not a Chicago Bull or a Bear or a Blackhawk. Is that right?
The Blackhawks would be, we don't have hockey in Cleveland, so that'd be okay.
No, okay, good. That's good to know. Interestingly enough, Bishop Eaton graduated with a music education degree from the College of Worcester before pursuing her call into parish ministry. Now, by all accounts, Bishop Eaton, you were a fantastic parish pastor, at least if we are to believe, and I'm sure we are, to all the interviews that were done by folks who knew you in those days. The Northeastern Ohio Synod, as a result, saw those gifts and elected you their bishop in 2006. It was in that capacity that you actually visited St. John's on September 16th, 2011, as we celebrated a covenant that was signed between the ELCA and the AME Zion churches. So welcome back to St. John's.
Thank you. Thanks.
Now, as noted, you are a product of Cleveland, which seems like a lot of folks know is one of the great food cities in the United States. Pierogies and Polish boys and corned beef sandwiches. Clevelanders love to claim that they invented brown mustard and lifesavers and maybe even ice cream cones. Now, as a good Lutheran, my guess is that you grew up around some darn good covered dish dinners. So my first question to you is, what is your favorite covered dish?
I didn't know what a covered dish was. It's a potluck, right? So a casserole, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I know it depends on what church I was visiting. And then if you went to the Saxon ones, like Klausenburg Kraut is really good, which is our Saxon sausage mixed up with, it's wonderful. It sounds horrible with sauerkraut and that sort of thing. So I have finally, though, in my travels, encountered tater tot hot dish.
Oh, my.
I kind of like that, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you are fortunate. You get to touch base with all the different regions in the country. Well, around the world, maybe. But noted potluck rather than covered dish. In the South, we call it covered dish.
They do out West, too. So that's the first time I heard about tater tot. No, they call it hot dish. Yeah, so it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. They call it hot dish. That's right.
Hot dish. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, just keeping with that Cleveland theme briefly, I have to ask a question about Cleveland sports because I know you're an avid fan. What's your favorite Cleveland sports figure?
Wow. Well, LeBron James still claims a piece of my heart.
Yeah.
He's a local guy, grew up in the Akron area and still does a lot of philanthropic work there. And he helped us to win the only championship that has happened in my lifetime in Cleveland. So I like his work really well.
That's exciting. Well, I promise, just one more Cleveland question. But I have to get in a question about the Rock and Roll Sports Hall of, or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. The 2020 inductees were recently nominated and every time were announced and every time they're announced, there's always great conversation about who was left off the list. So this year's list included people like Whitney Houston and Depeche Mode and the Doobie Brothers. I mean, all good choices, but it also means that there are still some great musicians out there who have not made the Hall of Fame. So I want to ask you, you can just answer yes or no. Which of the following should be in the Hall of Fame? Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Pat Benatar.
Well, probably.
Maybe Joe Cocker.
He's not in it yet?
Not yet. Can you believe that?
You're kidding me. Janis Joplin's, and why isn't Joe Cocker? He should have been in already. That's right. That's crazy.
Yeah. What about Tina Turner?
Ah, so beautiful.
Exactly. Right. How about Tina Turner?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Carole King.
Yes.
Absolutely. And then, of course, Dolly Parton.
In the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Rock and Roll, exactly. That's the question.
No, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I love her work, but no, that's different.
Yeah. A little bit different, huh? Let's get on to some important questions and important topics. In particular, your life as a pastor. We call you Bishop, of course, but my guess is your heart, your soul is as a pastor. You almost became a music educator, but at some point in your college career, I'm guessing in your college career or sometime in that era of your life, you changed direction. What do you love most about being a pastor in the church?
Probably something that we're all missing right now, since we have to shelter in place and do physical distancing. Just being with the people. And some people have said to me now, well, you know, I'm at the pinnacle of my call. And I would say, no, for me, that would be, and then you probably, Rhodes, have experienced this as well, is then you know your people. And I served the last parish I was there for 15 years. And you've walked with them so much, through so many things. You know, married them, baptized their babies, buried their parents, whatever. And when we would have communion, and we had a communion rail, and people would kneel, and you know, you'd go around, and then here's a newlywed couple, and you might, you know, give communion to them, and a few people down, here's a recent widow, or here's someone who just had a baby, or here's someone whose kid has gone off to college. So all those different life experiences, and they're all, you have a chance to be touched by them, but then also to have them, particularly in the sacrament, be connected to each other and to the source of life of Jesus. So that's the best. What I liked the least were committee meetings, but walking with my people was the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is beautiful and a beautiful response. I would wholeheartedly agree. Now, in that life as a pastor, but in your life in general, not just in your vocation, I'm sure you've experienced quite a bit of highs and lows, hopefully more highs than lows, maybe some real big extreme highs and maybe some horrible lows. This Sunday, the preaching text, at least the gospel text, is from Matthew 14 when Jesus comes to the disciples on stormy waters. You know the story, of course, that in Peter's exuberance, he walks on water toward Jesus, only to falter, to stumble, maybe lose faith. In other words, he collapses into the water. Has there been a time in your life when you have fallen, when you've collapsed into the waters of whatever those waters are, chaos or fear or maybe even lack of doubt?
Absolutely. I was serving a parish. We moved, so I was an interim pastor. And my father, who had a lot of underlying health problems, contracted what turned out to be fungal pneumonia. And my mother and I had to convince, we had like 5 minutes to make the decision to convince him to be intubated because they thought maybe they could get ahead of the disease. They did. And, you know, he lasted a week and then died. And then here I found myself, I was on communion calls visiting parishioners and bringing them Holy Communion. And I pulled up in this one driveway and they had a boat. And I just thought, what's the point? We're all going to die anyways. And I went through that really intense dry spell after my dad died. And, you know, I sometimes thought, well, maybe I should confess this to somebody, or am I being a hypocrite? It was really hard. But then I realized coming out of it then that the church was they were holding me. So the church, you know, like the Spirit, when could utter prayers too deep for words. Mm-hmm. And that was actually, even though it was painful, it was a gift that I could keep active in the community. And that was really hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I think also when I was first elected synod bishop, that was the worst I felt since my father had died. And then I'd say that I got over it. They're very, my staff is wonderful. Northeastern Ohio is the best synod ever. I know you're all my synods now. And then I think like the first 2 years in this call, I really struggled. It was really hard. I'm completely in over my head.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm for some reason, as you were speaking, especially about your father's death, your predecessor, H. Stuart Anderson, would often say at his wife's death that the church had to sing on his behalf. The church had to pray on his behalf. He'd mm-hmm. show up in worship and know that he could not sing or pray himself. That's a beautiful sort of role of the church, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was, if you think about the privilege that I had, mm-hmm. that I did. It was very clear that I wasn't going through this by myself, even though I sometimes felt that way. Mm-hmm. And I met Bishop Anderson for the second time in my life at Bishop Chilstrom's funeral in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I met him once when I was a pastor, and he was the speaker at our ministerium. I thought, I better go to that. So the second time I met him. So.
Well, we've had some remarkable leaders in our church, you included, certainly, and so we're thankful for them all. I don't know why I remember this, but your father, it struck me, you wrote somewhere that his father was an Irish Catholic, and your mom or your grandmother was a German Lutheran. Is that right?
Right. Yep.
And they somehow married and produced your father.
And my uncle. Yeah.
And your mm-hmm. uncle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like they were characters, and he was.
Oh my gosh. My mother says that my grandmother Eaton, that she was a flapper, so stylish and, you know, with it. And my grandfather, the family legend is, and I'm finding out that we used to think this was all made up, it probably wasn't, is that his dad gave him some money and said, go to the store and get a quart of milk. And so my grandfather left and was gone for 8 years, joined the circus, got married, came back with my grandmother, and I know my dad and my uncle, and the quart of milk. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Oh, that's great. That's good. Well, listen, speaking of challenges and fears, 2 weeks ago, as you know, the South Carolina Synod elected a new bishop, an excellent new bishop, Jenny Abishar.
Yeah, Jenny Abishar, she's great. And it was really, really impressive to see Jenny and then Jackie Utley right up there, too. Must mm-hmm. have been quite an assembly.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. I hate that it was, I mean, it had to be online, but, you know, it would have been lovely to be able to physically hug and embrace in those very special moments, but she'll be a great new bishop. But when the field was narrowed to 7 candidates, they were asked what they thought would be the biggest challenge facing the Synod over the next 6 years. And I thought, of course, responses would be very interesting, and they were. The dominant response was the pandemic. Now, whether that assessment is right or wrong, that's a conversation for another podcast, but what do you think is the church's biggest challenge in the next 6 years?
Our biggest challenge, and I think that the pandemic has made it really clear, is that the world changes all the time. And the change now is so rapid. And with the added stress of the coronavirus and sheltering in place, we've had to adapt. In a matter of a couple of weeks, people figured out how to do online worship, which was remarkable. But we know we have to do that as well, and we need to connect to people in ways that we haven't. It's been very clear, and I'm sure you've kept a track in St. John's as well, is that people who would never come to church will come to church online. Mm-hmm. And so how are we doing that? So our greatest challenge, and then our message is the same. Our message is the same, that God has shown unconditional, redeeming love in the death and resurrection of Jesus, and that the Spirit gives us the strength and the power to give that message. That's the same thing. But how do we engage people? We can't do it the way we have. And so remaining relevant, not that our message is not relevant, but people don't know about it. And so the churchwide expression, we've come up with our purpose statement, and we want this to be the one thing that we do well, and that is to activate each one of us to invite more people into the way of Jesus, community, justice, and love. But that's the big challenge. Are we going to be able to do that? And if you consider, by the middle of this century, white people will not be a majority. How are we then reaching people we wouldn't think of reaching, however, who have gifts and are they embody the diversity of creation that God so loves? So that's the challenge.
Well, no doubt, multiple challenges. Yeah, I mean, in this whole realm of it currently and in digital engagement, a movement towards digital discipleship, how to make a church that at least talks the talk, and I think in honest and authentic ways of being welcoming to people of color. And yet, we still struggle to find leaders who are people of color. It's just hard. And
It would be tough to be. I mean, I've had my own. I'm a white woman, middle class, wonderful family. My parents loved each other. My brothers are great, you know. And I've had struggles because I don't look with what people back in the 80s thought a pastor should look like. Mm-hmm. Well, how much more difficult would it be to be a person of color who has clearly heard the call and trust deeply in the grace of God, and you go to a congregation where no one looks like you, and they're not really sure that they want to look like you. Mm-hmm. And culturally, there's certain, I mean, often when we invite people into church, what we want them to do is become like us, which is maybe a normal human instinct, but we've got to expand what us means. Mm-hmm. I think it's really tough for when we do raise. So if we're raising up leaders of color, how are we supporting them, either as synods and bishops or colleagues for sure, in a ministry that's going to be more difficult for them and in ways that we don't understand? So you just can't you graduated, you got a call, you're on your own.
The recruitment process as well. Being able to identify, recruit, if recruit is the right word, but to help folks to discern, people of color, that this is a ministry that is for you and could be you'd have a very vibrant place, we hope, in the church. Mm-hmm. That's hard. Well, listen, I know that partly as a result of these challenges, the ELCA is in the process of reorganizing. I'm sure you're not at a place where you can reveal details, although I think that's coming soon, but in your opinion, and I'm speaking functionally and organizationally. You gave us a little bit of a tease of what a purpose statement, but what is the most important thing a reorganized churchwide unit should be doing?
We are trying to change the culture, not just of the churchwide organization, but across the church. And we wanted to see ourselves as one church, not getting rid of the three expressions, etc. But we all have this one thing that we have to do, which is to invite people into the way of Jesus. How do we do that? And then we want to, I know this is jargon, but to flatten the churchwide organization and so that push this out so that the way we do this, we can't do it by ourselves. In Chicago, but it's not possible. And it hasn't been effective, I would say, probably for the last 15 years, as much as we've tried to tweak that. But then how in this new organization do we also embody and encourage people to see that whatever ministry that you're doing at St. John's is the ELCA. So for example, if we were to flatten something out and say faith formation, yes, that's a critical ministry, but it doesn't have to be done or even led by the churchwide organization. That might be better done in congregations or other places. So how do we flatten that out? So not everything, and this is a lot of resistance, not just from people within the organization, but outside of the organization. We're somehow, like when we say we're going to have campus ministries as networks, that can be managed. We've done that. Well, then you just don't care about campus ministry anymore. Yes, we do. The network is the ELCA. So helping us to move our ministries closer to the places where it really has the most impact, which might not be in a centralized office. Mm-hmm. That's it. Helping us to understand that we're all in this together. The bishops are excited about this. There's some things that, that bishops and synods can do that the churchwide organization should hand off. And we don't have, I can't give you a lot of details because we don't have them all yet. We're still working on that. I mean, we better get with it, but, and we're bringing people into that conversation. So flattening the organization so that the mission is shared by all of us all across the church to the end that we're all activated to invite more people into the way of Jesus.
Good. That's enough of a tease. I certainly appreciate that. Rubber hits the road right in that pew, right? And the ways in which folks in our pews are motivated by the gospel, are fed at the table, and sent out into the world. So yeah, let's focus that energy and attention right there where that rubber hits the road. You've been ordained, I think, 39 years. Is that right?
39 years.
39. Yeah. Congratulations. A year early.
Just to let you know.
You were what?
12. When I was ordained.
Okay. Excellent. Wow. Just amazing. Knowing what you know now, what is the one thing you would add to the seminary curriculum? And then secondly, it's sort of related, but one thing that you that you think must be given renewed emphasis in the seminary curriculum?
Wow. Well, it's been a long time since I've been in seminary, but I've been on seminary campuses. What needs to be, what I would see needs to be strengthened and emphasized. I want our leaders to be scriptural, theological, confessional, liturgical, and this has nothing to do with musical styles, entrepreneurial, faithful leaders. So I'm discouraged sometimes or surprised that a good confessional understanding and witness to scripture is not apparent in places where it should be. So that would be really important. But to add a course, and maybe they're doing this now, I wish I had some sort of course on how to manage a nonprofit. Because as a parish pastor, it's a nonprofit. And so we go from, you know, I was fortunate that I started out as an assistant pastor so I could learn from somebody. But I'm thinking about pastors who graduate, go right to a congregation and have no business experience, no understanding of how to run a nonprofit. And that's daunting. So that would be, maybe they're doing that. I don't know.
Maybe in some places, but with reduced income and resources on seminary campuses, it's sort of hard to have everything that you need.
I think they want us to pick some of that up in internship. I think that's part of it, but just to be intentional to understand, you better understand how to read a budget. You better understand how to work with volunteers. Understand how to have a vision and a plan and not just, well, I'm going to get through the week. You better understand how to be engaged and rooted in your community, the one where the parish is, as well as the community who might be driving in.
Well, the church is much like our community, small and large. I know in our particular Salisbury community, we recognize the real strong need to develop young leaders just to in the nuances of being a leader. So the church needs also to very actively train their pastors how to be a leader.
Right.
Very important. Good. A couple of questions about social justice. I know that's very clearly important part of your ministry, and especially in the way that you shepherd the church. We've heard a lot of discouraging statistics and trends surrounding issues of social justice, especially things regarding poverty, systemic inequities, especially in regards to race and imprisonment. But I found this interesting, and hopefully it will be for you. Early this week, Ozzie reported that the number of Black Americans in state and federal prisons has dropped by one-third since 2006. Now, still, the rate of imprisonment among Black Americans is five times higher than the rate for white Americans. It's improving, yes, but it's still troubling, still very discouraging. But here's a question. Are there other trends that you can point to that show positive movement in the area of social justice? We hear a lot about the negative movement. Anything that you see that shows positive movement in the area of social justice?
After the murder of George Floyd, people, all kinds of people, took to the streets to march and to protest, overwhelmingly peaceful protests, not what we're seeing on the news in such a way. And then so I talked with a colleague who's African American, and he said, maybe this time, because it wasn't just Black folks out there, and it was everybody, all ages, ethnicities out there saying, you know, getting it. And that doesn't mean that when people get so inflamed, I think when they hear Black Lives Matter, the woman who coined that phrase originally said Black might lives still matter. But to say we've got to recognize that built into the system, which we've inherited, we're not the bad people, but we've inherited is definite inequities, financial, educational, health. I mean, depending on your zip code, at least here in Chicago, depends on your life expectancy in some ways. So, and not an ability to move out of those things. So we're seeing that now, and everyone's seeing it. So that gives me hope that it's not just this sort of niche issue that has to do with them, but we're seeing, no, this is about all of us. Mm-hmm. That's hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Painful, but it's hopeful.
Well, it's been a very painful last few months, but yeah, to be able to see some measure of hope in the midst of that pain is encouraging, no doubt. We have a very rich partnership with Christian brothers and sisters in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And so we reached out to them to ask what they would like to ask you. Now, as of course you know, the conflict between in Palestine and in the Holy Land continues to exist. It's existed for generations. The conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, the challenges regarding one state versus two state solutions or settlements or the wall, whatever it is, you name it, all are hot topics. What's easy to overlook is the steady decrease in the number of Christians living in the Holy Land. In fact, recently the Orthodox Patriarchate in Jerusalem said that Christians are, and this is a quote, are at risk of being driven out of the Holy Land, quoted in The Guardian. Here's a question from our ministry partner. How are American Lutherans to think about Palestine and Israel and the possibility that Christians might be effectively removed from that area?
That's a huge issue. And when I've spoken with people in the government of the state of Israel, they say, well, no, we've got more Christians than any other place in the Middle East, but not Arab Christianity. And that's what's really being threatened right now. They've been Christian for, Amitri Rahab's one of their pastors and said, mm-hmm. we were Jesus babysitters, okay? So yes, it's the pressure on Arab Christians in that area, in particular on Arab Christians in Palestine and the Palestinian Authority, is relentless. Mm-hmm. And so in Gaza, I don't know how many Christians are down there, but they're basically in a blockade, in a siege. But also in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem and the West Bank, unemployment is high. In fact, our church is one of the largest employers there. To get hospital care. Our government, the United States government, cut off U.S. aid to the East Jerusalem hospitals. That's the only place where particularly Palestinian cancer patients can get care. And so that makes it really difficult. So you're what's the future for your children? And if you're a young person, what's your future? So if you can leave, then I understand why that seems to be a viable choice for people. It's really hard to live under occupation, which in a lot of ways is it's confusing and disorienting because it's not consistent. So some days you can get through the checkpoint, but then some days you have to wait for hours to get through the checkpoint. And they're suffering doubly now with the COVID, with the pandemic, the COVID virus. So they have that, they're locked down for that. The unemployment is high. The Palestinian Authority, I don't think has done, they're not exactly stellar in the way that they administer things, but they're hampered by the Israeli government. It's just hard, and they're a minority. Most folks in Palestine are Muslims, though the Christians, at least are the Lutheran, the ELCJHL, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land, they have a pretty good relationship with their Muslim neighbors. That's not an issue, but it's hard. We were in one of the schools, I don't know how many years ago, and so we were meeting with the kids who'd be high school, our equivalent of high school seniors, and we would be saying, well, what do you want to be doing in 10 years? And, oh, I want to be a doctor, and I want to be a teacher. And this one kid said, I want to be alive. Mm-hmm. And that was, that's hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've painted a stark picture of life in Palestine right now, and it's true. I think in Bethlehem, they rely 80% of their dollar is tourism dollar, I believe, and so right now tourism is zero. It's critical. But what about when the political mantra so often is pro-Israel? I mean, it's almost people are judged, politicians and others are judged based on how they respond to that question of, are you pro-Israel or not? And I don't mean to get there except to say, how are American Lutherans to think about this challenge that you've painted in Palestine and in Israel?
It's important for us to make a distinction between Israel and Jews and the government of Israel. And so Jews in this country are also critical of the government of Israel. But I think people have to be careful not to slip into anti-Semitism or be too afraid of being accused of being an anti-Semite when we're criticizing the government of Israel. Mm-hmm. Of course, our work, which is we take the lead from our partners there, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land, is that a two-state solution for Israelis and Palestinians, for Jews, Christians, and Muslims, that for us is what we're hoping and working and praying for. There will never be a secure Israel without an independent Palestine. And there will never be an independent Palestine without a secure Israel. Mm-hmm. So that's what we try to balance. I've been regularly accused of hating Israel and being anti-Semitic. And then some people also tell me that I'm not showing proper or enough concern for life under occupation that Palestinian people. So I don't know. Get it both ways. It's an incredibly, incredibly complex situation. Incredibly complex. There are no easy solutions. And then it's difficult. So I think it's legitimate to criticize some of the actions of the government of Israel. For example, Netanyahu's announced plan to annex huge chunks of the Palestinian Authority's area granted from after 1968, that's legitimate. And we do that. When we do it, though, we make sure that we talk to our Jewish colleagues first. So those agencies and organizations with whom we are in dialogue to say, we're going to be speaking about this. But it doesn't stop us from speaking what we believe needs to be said. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it is down in the South, but when I traveled to churches and synods, you know, in Minnesota and the Dakotas and Montana, that we haven't paid attention to and are starting to, is will we resolve land, sharing land that was taken from Native American people? Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we've got a huge issue for us to resolve. And if we think about that, I mean, I met with the ranchers after I was at Standing Rock, and they love their land and they are good stewards of their land and they've been on their land for generations. However, before any European settlers came over, the native folks were on that land and have been pushed off. that might give us a sense of how complex it is with Israel and Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Well, very helpful that you simply say, not simply, but that you say, let's take the lead of our partner church there on the ground, right? The Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan and the Holy Land.
There you go.
Because unfortunately, their voice is not around the table very often. The Christian voice is not around the table very often, and it's a critically important voice to be at the table in this conversation. So supporting those voices, amplifying those voices, and other Christian leaders in that community is critically important. And we have some outstanding leaders, Lutheran leaders, in that region. So thank you for saying that. Well, listen, our time is probably coming to an end. Unfortunately, I would love to ask lots more questions, but I would love to ask you, what is your hope for this church? We live in an era where we wring our hands often until they're raw over worry for our church. But what is your hope for our church?
My hope is that all of us and this church would live as if we really, truly believed that the resurrection happened. Mm. I had someone in a sermon once say that when you're baptized, you've already died the only death that really matters. And if we truly believe, not to say things are going to be easy, not to minimize the actual suffering and I think anxiety that we're facing right now, but if we truly believe that Jesus was raised from the dead and Jesus is Lord of this church, that ought to give us a lot of freedom not to fret about stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, no doubt that is great hope. Of all people and of all times, Chris Pratt, you might remember from Parks and Recreation, the MTV Awards last year, said that, and I believe he grew up Lutheran, said that he gave 9 things that you need to know. One thing you need to know is that God loves you deeply. Bishop Eaton, thank you so much for this conversation, mostly for your partnership. God is using you in a very unique way to proclaim the gospel and to lead the church. You are, as we have heard many, many times, wise, eager, provocative, yet you're down to earth and humble. And that's been very, very evident today. So thank you. May God bless you in your continued ministry and in the ministry that we share as disciples on this journey. So thank you for your time with us today. To learn more about Bishop Eaton and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, visit their website, elca.org. Thank you again. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Conversations That Matter, where we engage in conversation with thoughtful, passionate leaders who are making a difference in our community and in our lives. Until next time.